Where are we at with the literature regarding the use of mechanical CPR devices?
This is more than an algorithm. This is more than a cookbook, a recipe that you follow. There should be some end game here. CPR is not life-sustaining, it's only death-prolonging. Being dead is a pretty effective vagal nerve inhibitor. I can almost hear the clock ticking in the back of my head that I'm taking too long. The success of this therapy is going to live or die based on patient selection.
Welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. I'm Mike Winters from the University of Maryland, and this is the February 2015 podcast. We realize we're getting this out to you a bit late in the month. We had a few technical challenges this month while recording. Nevertheless, we've got a great podcast for you this month. We're going to talk with resuscitation expert Dr. Joshua Reynolds on the modern management of cardiac arrest. What are the things that we need to know to increase our chances of getting return of spontaneous circulation and, more importantly, meaningful neurologic recovery or survival upon hospital discharge? Josh has done a tremendous amount of research in this area, publishing in some key journals, Circulation, Resuscitation, on various aspects of managing the patient in cardiac arrest. Really great to have him on the podcast. So without further ado, let's jump into our discussion on the modern management of cardiac arrest. All right, we're going to jump into our February 2015 segment. Joining us is someone that I've wanted to get on the podcast for a very long time, an expert in resuscitation, an expert in the resuscitation of patients in cardiac arrest. He is Dr. Joshua Reynolds. He's currently an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine in the College of Human Medicine at Michigan State University in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Josh is a former resident at the University of Maryland, and following residency, he went to Pittsburgh for a period of time and now is up in Michigan. So our thanks, Josh, for joining us on the podcast this month.
Oh, it's great. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely great to have you. And the reason that we brought you on is because we want to talk to you as our cardiac arrest and resuscitation expert, how to best manage cardiac arrest patients in 2015. In other words, what's the modern management of cardiac arrest? And the reason we got Josh on is he's authored some excellent, outstanding chapters in a recent textbook by Amal Mattu put out by ACEP entitled Cardiovascular Emergencies. Josh's chapter is on the modern management of cardiac arrest, and he is also one of my authors for the second edition, actually the first and second edition, of ED Resuscitation of the Critically Ill, also due out, I think, early 2016. So there's no one better to talk about the modern management of cardiac arrests. And what we're going to talk about over the course of this podcast discussion is, what do you really need to know? What are the things that you have to do to get the best rate of return of spontaneous circulation? And ultimately, all of our goals is to get that patient out of the hospital with meaningful neurologic survival. So any opening comments, Josh, before we get started?
Yeah, no, again, thanks for having me. I think the most important takeaway for all this is that there's a lot of talk about the chain of survival, and we do that for a reason. Resuscitation really spans the pre-hospital setting, the ED setting, the ICU setting, and now as we're starting to learn more and more, the inpatient and the post-discharge rehabilitation setting. And so each link, as it were, in this chain is equally as important as any other.
Well, I think the best way to go through our discussion, rather than just have you sit back and give us a lecture, I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions and just have you take it away as we roll through this talk. In terms of the actual resuscitation, we get that call, the patient's coming in, we're getting, let's just say the report is, you know, you got 2 minutes before the patient arrives. Even before the patient gets there, how are you organizing your team? What are you thinking about getting things ready and prepped for when that patient rolls through the door?
Yeah, good question. So I know there's a lot talked about team dynamics and management style and assigning roles, much like the trauma model we use. And all that is good and all those are important things to do. But honestly, the main thing that I'm thinking about is trying to get a sense of how salvageable I think this patient is in terms of age, downtime, presenting rhythm. So the first thing I'm thinking about is what's my potential here for more aggressive resuscitation strategies that we can talk about later on in the podcast, things like ECLS and ECMO. But for the traditional ED-based provider, all the things about team management and assigning roles are going to be the things I'm thinking about.
And then in terms of just an overarching theme, we had John Greenwood a few months ago talk about hemodynamic directed resuscitation, and he touched on the topic of coronary perfusion pressure. Kind of go into that a little bit more for us, and is this something that you're really basing your efforts to maximize coronary perfusion pressure on?
Yeah, so coronary perfusion pressure is the pressure head that the myocardium sees that actually perfuses the myocardium. It's a simple equation. It is the diastolic arterial pressure less the central venous pressure, the right atrial pressure. And Norm Paradis in Detroit is the one who originally did the studies in the early 80s. And this is where we get the number 15 from. 15 millimeters of mercury is the coronary perfusion pressure that really is the requirement to get returnal pulses back. And so the name of the game really is about maximizing coronary perfusion pressure, which is important to reperfuse the myocardium. It actually washes out all the evil humors that build up during ischemic time and restores energy substrates, restores ATP, and actually primes the myocardium, so to speak, for successful defibrillation.
All right, so that's kind of what we're driving our resuscitation to, maximizing coronary perfusion pressure, correct?
Absolutely.
All right, so let's go through some things. The patient rolls in, they get put in our resuscitation bay. I think all of us know high-quality chest compressions is extremely important. But take us through the pearls and potentially the pitfalls on what is meant by high-quality chest compressions. What are you focusing on and what are your targets?
Yeah, so the nuts and bolts of this are really nicely delineated by Bill Core and the American Heart Association. And I'm sure we can expect to see some slight refinements to these guidelines with the new guidelines in 2015. But really, you want to see depth greater than 2 inches. You want to drive the rate up at least above 100, probably closer to 120 is better. You want to get complete recoil of the hands. You want to see a high chest compression fraction, which is really just the time spent doing compressions over the time during a resuscitation. That's the inverse of hands-off time. I like to shoot for at least 80% chest compression fraction.
So I like that pearl regarding 100 to 120 in terms of the rate, allowing complete recoil. I've also seen some things regarding avoiding leaning. So that person who's doing the chest compressions has some effect on intrathoracic pressure, decreased right atrial, or maybe increased right atrial pressure and decreased venous return. I think that's something that many, many providers do when we deliver CPR. What's your thoughts on leaning?
Yeah, as you just said, absolutely. It really all comes down to trying to get as perfect technique as possible.
And then in terms of the maintaining that high chest compression fraction, so targeting greater than 80%, I think many of our listeners are aware of limiting any type of interruption in high-quality chest compressions. We'll get to some other things a little bit later, such as ultrasound and perhaps mechanical CPR devices. But one of the other big things is early defibrillation. So establish team leadership, assign roles, high-quality chest compressions, and early defibrillation. In order to minimize those interruptions in high-quality compressions, what are your thoughts on perishock pauses, and then subsequently, what's the current literature say regarding hands-on defibrillation?
Yeah, controversial topic. So it's interesting, perishock pause is really the clinical manifestation of this idea of coronary perfusion pressure. If you look in the animal models, you can actually very nicely see how even brief periods of hands-off time, brief interruptions in CPR result in this very dramatic and precipitous drop-off in coronary perfusion pressure, and then it takes some period of time of doing chest compressions again to build up that pressure head to get back above that threshold. And so perishock pause, like I said, really is the clinical manifestation of this, and it's a term that really didn't exist before 5 or so years ago, same with chest compression fraction. And it's the idea that you want to minimize the period of time between the last chest compression and the actual delivery of the defibrillation. And there are a variety of techniques you can do to minimize that, one being what the Pacific Northwest has coined the term the Seattle switch, that being the idea of charging the defibrillator during chest compressions and then minimizing that interruption to make it as short as possible, where you simultaneously deliver a defibrillation and then immediately rotate compressors and resume CPR to get that perishock pause down to as brief a time as possible. In terms of hands-on defibrillation, it's a controversial topic. You know, everybody's probably familiar with a proof-of-concept study where they lined up a number of volunteers and delivered shocks with a biphasic defibrillator. Every volunteer had on polyethylene gloves, and no one reported any sensation at all. It's interesting that it's actually the defibrillator manufacturers that have kind of taken this in the other direction and have done the more benchtop type testing to see if the glove material will withstand the amount of current or the amount of energy delivered by the defibrillator. A lot of people have anecdotes about doing hands-on defibrillation. I've done it a few times myself, never had any type of untoward sensation. But I should note that I think it was Scott Weingart wrote a letter to the editor of Resuscitation a few years ago delineating how he himself had performed hands-on defibrillation a number of times without any incidents until one time when he developed something like some rather painful residual paresthesias in his arms. This is probably boils down to some low-level amount of risk that accumulates over time, accumulates over exposure, but it's really unknown exactly what that risk is or exactly how much exposure you need to accumulate material risk.
Probably not something that we should consider standard at this point and more data needed on it.
Well, my off-literature biased opinion is that it probably is safe in certain settings, but it's hard to quantify just how much your risk accrues over time or over exposure.
All right, well stated. All right, another controversial topic. So the patient comes in, team leadership, high-quality compressions, early defibrillation, always comes up about the question of airway. When to intervene? Do we do passive oxygenation, say with bag valve mask, or perhaps a little bit of supported ventilation? Do we place a supraglottic airway? Do we go ahead and do endotracheal intubation? Where are we at with respect to airway management? When should it occur? And if so, which airway device should we be looking at?
Yeah, it's a great question. Another controversial topic, one with definitely mixed evidence. It seems like every new meta-analysis you read points you in a different direction. Well, I can say this. So the paramedics in West Michigan love to intubate, and so it's very rare that I see anymore a cardiac arrest patient that doesn't come without an endotracheal tube. In general, I am of the camp that I'm very happy with a supraglottic airway for initial purposes. I think there are more important things to do off the bat than to muck around in the airway and have halting, interrupted chest compressions. And so I'm perfectly happy with a supraglottic airway up front and then delaying definitive airway management till a little later in the resuscitation.
All right, so great point in terms of the airway. And as an airway monitoring method, regardless of which modality you choose, say supraglottic versus endotracheal intubation, are all your patients getting put on waveform capnography?
Yeah, that's pretty much standard of care in my hospital, and it really should be. The color change capnographs are fine and well, but you know, every once in a while they expire or something goes wrong in the chamber, and so having a persistent, reliable, propagating, reassuring signal that you're actually in the airway, I think, is and should be the standard of care.
All right, so moving on to yet another controversial topic. So team leadership, high-quality compressions, early defibrillation, plus-minus airway. I think many of us are ready and willing to place or administer medications. And I certainly think epi is central in terms of what many of us are administering for these patients. But lots of recent literature questioning the utility of epinephrine. I think much of it has shown that, well, it can result in improved rates of ROSC, but actually whether it improves meaningful neurologic survival upon hospital discharge, I think a tremendous amount of observational literature to say, well, probably it doesn't. There's one recent publication, I think a relatively large observational study by Dumas in the Journal of American College of Cardiology that just got published a few months ago, once again highlighting this controversy. Where do you stand with respect to medications in the setting of cardiac arrest resuscitation?
Yeah, so it's certainly a hard habit to break and one that we've spent decades developing. So for me, I think the literature is sufficient enough to throw out just about everything. I think there probably is still a role for epinephrine. The role that we're currently using it in does not seem to be the best one. Like you said, there is mountains now of observational evidence. The Dumas trial, there's a matched cohort study out of Japan with tens of thousands of patients showing that, as you said earlier, improvements in ROSC, but no improvements in survival or neurologically intact survival. In terms of epinephrine itself, I think, at least anecdotally, most people have observed that everybody benefits from epi at least once. There's probably a role for one dose of epi, but the way we use it now in terms of repeated dosing in an algorithmic fashion, I think we're just overloading the catecholamine receptors. I think the brain is taking a hit in terms of cerebral perfusion pressure. And so it really begs the question, is there a better way to use it? It sounds like Dr. Greenwood alluded to that on one of your earlier podcasts in terms of trying to make some physiologically intelligent decisions during resuscitation in terms of hemodynamic resuscitation and using epinephrine in a more intelligent fashion.
You know, one of the things John talked about just gets back to what we led off the podcast or discussion with, and that's maximizing coronary perfusion pressure. So you had talked about targeting a CPP of greater than 15, and I think we can kind of delve into this, but I think very few, if any, patient in the emergency department coming in cardiac arrest is going to have both a central line and an A-line placed.
Correct.
Placing an A-line is something that can be reasonably achieved depending on your resources. I'm guessing most would attempt a femoral A-line. So let's kind of delve into that a little bit more so. And then based upon what you're targeting, let's say for a diastolic pressure, is that how you're dosing your epinephrine?
Yeah, it is. And it's something we're kind of moving towards, something I'm trying to steer the ship in that direction in my hospital. So actually, I really started challenging my residents to try to place arterial lines during cardiac arrest, something that I challenged myself to do. It's something that is a little tricky, but does get easier with practice. Obviously, I think the femoral route is probably the easiest way to go. the one human study that Norm Paradis did in Detroit, you know, he found his cut point was about 15 millimeters of mercury. Anybody that couldn't get above 15, nobody got return of pulses back. There's some methodological issues with that study, obviously. In the early 80s, they were putting in invasive lines under fluoro, if my memory serves, in the emergency department. So by the time you could actually get the lines in and get numbers on the monitor, get some data back, you were way, way, way far into resuscitation. And so probably farther out than what we see in the emergency department, typically. And so it really begs the question, is that target higher up front? I did some work with this in a swine model, and we found our cut point early on in pigs, at least, was closer to 30 millimeters of mercury. So the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. So in terms of a number to pick, assuming you can get an arterial line in, I go by diastolic blood pressure. And so if you want to see a CPP of, let's say, 20 to 25, and we're going to guesstimate that our CVP is anywhere from 5 to 10 or 5 to 15, then really I want to see a diastolic arterial pressure of about 40 to 50 would be ideal. And obviously, not everyone is going to be able to get an A-line in or have those capabilities. I think a nice surrogate for that is going to be end-tidal CO2.
And in terms of that, what would be your target number for end-tidal CO2?
Yeah, so I have to plead trends here over numbers. I think, obviously, there's been a lot of work done trying to find the magic cutoff of end-tidal CO2. We all know that when the numbers go up, it's a good thing. Probably indicates return to circulation. When the numbers go down, it's a bad thing. If you can't generate anything, then your resuscitation is probably going to be unsuccessful. But I really haven't seen any definitive magic numbers. So for me, it's all about trends. As long as my end tidal is going up or going in the right direction or staying up, then I know I'm doing the right thing. If it's going down, then I know it's time to change something. Either give another dose of epinephrine, reevaluate my chest compressor, make sure that their technique is correct. Maybe they're getting tired and I need to change out a new person. So for me, it's more of a barometer of success.
Okay, so let me just kind of summarize that. So with respect to wrapping this back to the epinephrine discussion, patients are coming in, you're perhaps giving them a single dose or initial dose of epinephrine up front, trying to establish the A-line, targeting a diastolic pressure around, you said, 40 to 50 millimeters of mercury. And in the absence of an A-line, using end-tidal CO2 as a surrogate, but then as the resuscitation continues, if you're hitting those targets, you're continuing with chest compressions and avoiding further dosing of epi. However, if you're under that and haven't achieved those either of those targets, then you go ahead with an additional dose of epinephrine. Would that seem correct?
Correct. And all the while, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, you know, where are we going with this? I'll take a step back and just say that I think the astute resuscitationist is going to quickly figure out that this is more than an algorithm. This is more than a cookbook, a recipe that you follow. I think the pitfall is to follow the algorithm that you have on your card and get to the end and say, oh, well, it didn't work. I guess we'll just quit. The overriding theme here should be that we're trying to make some physiologically intelligent decisions, and really there should be some end game here. I had a mentor in fellowship that used to say, CPR is not life-sustaining, it's only death-prolonging. You don't see people walking around getting chest compressions.
Well said.
So really, in my mind, even when you get the radio call, I'm always thinking, what's our end game? Is this somebody that would benefit from mechanical reperfusion or mechanical support? And really, the traditional ACLS either becomes a means to an end, or in someone who is not a good candidate for those kind of therapies. I mean, obviously, we do what we do, and we stick with what we have because it's the best we have. But for me, ACLS is, in a perfect world, a means to an end.
Well, let me finish or wrap up our drug discussion. So that was the thought on epinephrine. But let me ask you a few other things. Certainly, atropine is out, correct?
Yeah, that's pretty well and gone. At best, it does nothing. At worst, it harms people. And honestly, being dead is a pretty effective vagal nerve inhibitor.
All right. Well, what about two other medications that I commonly see administered during resuscitation? Bicarbonate and then calcium. Any role for empiric use of either of these medicines?
No, and I'll add TPA to that mix too. Routine road administration of calcium bicarbonate TPA, really, there's no evidence to support these whatsoever. They really should be used in select situations where you have enough of an index of suspicion to warrant it.
And then how about antiarrhythmics?
Yeah, so antiarrhythmics, that's interesting. There is a trial going on right now studying pre-hospital amio versus lidocaine versus placebo. I guess I'll have to hold off until the results of the trial come back.
But in general?
Yeah, in general, there's never been any really neurologic benefit shown from routine use.
All right. Well, let's move into a few adjuncts, novel things. We talked about end-tidal CO2, using that certainly if we have nothing else, if we can't establish an A-line. Lots of utility to end-tidal CO2 probably should be standard for all cardiac resuscitations. But something that's frequently used in many of our settings, whether it's be the ED or ICU, is ultrasound. We're using it as an initial diagnostic evaluation tool. Does this patient have a rapidly reversible cause of their cardiac arrest? We're intervening. But something that I've also noticed, and Mike Allison, one of our EMIMCC fellows, has lectured on and written on, is that perhaps we may be using ultrasound too frequently, and getting back to our high-quality compressions, maybe it's interrupting high-quality compressions and really decreasing that chest compression fraction ratio. Is this something that you've seen as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Even when I'm doing it myself with the ultrasound probe, I can almost hear the clock ticking in the back of my head that I'm taking too long. So I think it was Kenny Malamat just put out a pearl on the UMEM Pearls email listserv about taking a video clip instead of trying to muck around and figure out what's what, just to put the probe on, take a video clip, take the probe off, and then you can hem and haw over the video clip while CPR is ongoing again.
Yeah, that's a great, great pearl. Let me ask you, while we're on the ultrasound topic of, say, transthoracic, there's been some discussion in the social media, the blogosphere, about actually using TEE during resuscitation, and that would avoid perhaps some of this interruption in chest compressions. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly carries face validity. The couple times that I've had cardiology come down for some more advanced support or mechanical support, it's interesting. When a cardiologist asks for a TEE, they're down there within about 45 seconds. So it's a little tougher for us unless you have the equipment right there. But in principle, I think it's a great idea.
And then in terms of delivering high-quality compressions, we alluded to this a few minutes ago, but where are we at with the literature regarding the use of mechanical CPR devices?
Yeah, great question. So I think the literature has been pretty abundantly clear time and time again that there's really no benefit for just routine, everyday, widespread, universal use. Certainly the chest compression quality is better. No one can argue with that. But in terms of actually making meaningful clinical impact, we've really failed to show that time and time again on multiple different continents. I'm going to go kind of off-label here. I think there's probably still is a role for mechanical CPR in terms of being a leverage that you can use to drive towards ECMO and ECLS. So my sort of off-literature opinion, and I think the one that probably a lot of people would agree with, is that if you're going to take a patient who's out in the field and try to extricate them and put them in the back of an ambulance and have any meaningful CPR done in the back of a bouncing ambulance, probably the best way to do that is with a machine. Certainly, machines perform better quality chest compressions than humans do, and I think in that isolated role of driving towards an end game of mechanical support, there's probably a role for a mechanical CPR device.
Well, let me, since you mentioned ECMO and ECLS a few times now, let's kind of delve into your thoughts on that. But before doing so, I think one of the, not controversial things, but one of the questions that comes up is, when do we consider moving towards these novel therapies, primarily ECMO? ECMO or ECLS. In other words, when do we consider this to be refractory to high-quality CPR, early defibrillation, plus minus doses of epinephrine and the establishment of an airway? Is there any time cutoff where beyond which we should really be thinking about moving towards novel therapies?
Yeah, good question. Something I actually studied in the Western Pennsylvania region. It's about 1,000 patient sample. The answer to your question is it's a lot earlier than you would think. In the Western Pennsylvania population, the drop-off in neurologically intact survival happens at about 10 to 15 minutes into professional resuscitation. So if you look at the whole sample, kind of moving through time from the beginning of pre-hospital professional resuscitation moving through time, and you plot, you know, the x-axis is time and the y-axis is proportion with neurologically intact survival, that curve really takes a deep dive after about 15 minutes. And so really, for me, you know, I interpret that to mean that if by 10 to 15 minutes out in the field we're not getting anywhere, then it's time to think about plan B. And it really is a question of, when do you move from plan A to plan B, and at what point does the risk-benefit ratio swing the other way, you know, towards a plan B and towards more aggressive support?
Well, let's jump into the ECMO-ECLS discussion. Certainly something that's gotten a lot of attention. I'd say probably over the last 1 to 2 years, a number of trials have come out regarding the benefit of ECLS in cardiac arrest. There's a few articles in resuscitation in the ED as well as the inpatient unit. Where are we settling out with the literature? Do we know which patients benefit as of yet? Who should we be considering this in? We know sort of now beyond which time limit, but are there any ideal candidates?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's very exciting. I feel like this is finally something new under the sun that we're seeing for cardiac arrest patients. The success of this therapy is going to live or die based on patient selection. And if you look at probably the most advanced system, or the folks from Japan, Ken Nagao is kind of leading the way over there. The Japanese system, the San Diego system, and to some extent some other systems cropping up in the U.S., the common denominator in patient selection seems to be they need to be young-ish the ideal candidate has an initially shockable rhythm, but I think there's probably a role for select non-shockable rhythm candidates. The ideal candidate, obviously, is a witnessed arrest. I think that's probably the most important thing. It's got to be someone that is either directly witnessed or somebody just saw them alive a few minutes ago. The person that someone finds down is not a good candidate for this therapy. And so you really want to see someone who's young-ish, ideally with a shockable rhythm, ideally a witnessed arrest, and has some sort of minimal, what we term as no-flow time, a very brief amount of time where there is no bystander CPR or no professional CPR done.
Great, great points. Now, I'll admit we do a lot of ECMO at our shop. However, you know, we're still a little bit slow to get this up and running and working with our CT surgeons in the ED. So we, as of yet, don't have a protocol. Are you working on one, or do you have one established at Michigan?
Yeah, something we're working on. I actually just met with our ED director and some of the nursing administrators for the ECMO folks to hammer out a protocol for the ED. It's something that, you know, it can be done. I've made it happen in my emergency department. Something that takes a lot of inertia to get going, but once you get it going, it can actually happen pretty quickly. So it is something we're working on and trying to formalize a pathway for.
Outstanding. Well, you covered a tremendous amount of pearls already, but while I have you on the phone, I just want to get your thoughts on some post-arrest pearls. We've done all of this. Let's just say we've achieved return of spontaneous circulation. Now we've got to go through some additional steps to make sure that this patient has the greatest chance of walking out of the hospital with meaningful neurologic survival. I think we're attuned to getting the patient ventilated, now if performing intubation, getting a definitive airway established. I think in years past, perhaps as you and I trained, even maybe before you and I trained, maybe plus minus some vasopressors, getting the patient accepted to the ICU, and then who is next in the chart rack. But there's so much more to post-arrest care, and I think you've highlighted some initial big things, such as regionalization. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think regionalized care makes a lot of sense. It works for STEMI, it works for stroke, works for trauma. I think this is another population where the single biggest thing this population needs is to go to a hospital that has a very well-worn path for them to follow, where there are providers there that are familiar with these types of patients and what they need. The old way of throwing them on some dopamine, admitting to the ICU, and going to do something else just doesn't cut it anymore. And these patients need a lot of intensive care up front. And really, in the ED, it's probably tempting to think that most of the important things happen upstairs in the ICU, but I would argue that that first hour after return of pulses, where they're sitting in the ED waiting for the ICU bed, that's probably the most important hour in terms of getting them going on the right path and the right trajectory.
Now, in terms of the components of post-arrest care, let me just kind of touch on targeted temperature management. And we didn't mention this at the beginning, but to all of our listeners, Josh has actually been really involved with the upcoming recommendations from ILCOR regarding many aspects of resuscitation, but specifically targeted temperature management. So until that publication comes out, he really can't give the official word or official opinion on which temperature to target. But what I wanted to ask him, Josh, when you institute targeted temperature management, can you give us some pitfalls that you see that perhaps we can avoid?
Yeah, I'm happy to do so. These are all pitfalls that I've fallen into myself, having done about 100 or so of these folks. So I think that the three biggest mistakes that I've made and probably are easy for other people to make are, number one, just under-resuscitating these patients in general. No matter what temperature you select, these patients inevitably get some degree of a cold diuresis. And so it's helpful to think of these patients or to think of the post-cardiac arrest syndrome as being very similar to sepsis in terms of having a plan and sticking to a plan. Most of these folks are just under-resuscitated. And so it's important to fill the tank before squeezing the pipes, you know, as the old adage goes. And then the second one is, in the process of going down in temperature, you're going to see some degree of low normal or mildly low potassium. And so the second biggest pitfall is banging your head against the wall 24 to 36 hours trying to hammer these patients with potassium to get the numbers to normalize, only to find that upon rewarming, all that potassium you've put into them is still there, and they become hyperkalemic on rewarming. So it's okay to live with low normal or even mildly low potassium levels because it's just artificially low in the setting of being cold. Then the third biggest pitfall that I fell into once and only once is it's important not to walk away from the ventilator in these folks. I remember clearly one time paralyzed a patient for shivering, walked away from the ventilator for a while, and then was called back because the patient was becoming more and more hypotensive and nobody could figure out what the problem was. And then it finally dawned on us that we had paralyzed him and we checked a gas and he was profoundly acidemic. So once we addressed that, then his pressure normalized and he did okay. But you often need to paralyze these folks to stop the shivering, and it's important to be checking frequent gases after you do so.
Great, great pearl. Let me ask about hemodynamics. Certainly a lot of these patients in the immediate post-Roski period are very hemodynamically labile. Now, in terms of shooting for perfusion pressures, I think many of us, many of our listeners, are very attuned to remembering 65 as a mean arterial pressure, especially in the setting of, say, sepsis resuscitation. But is that the right number that we should be choosing in our post-arrest patients?
Yeah, it's a great question. It probably is not. You know, obviously we're lacking an RCT here, but there's certainly mounting observational evidence that you probably need to drive towards a higher MAP in these folks. This is one area where these type of patients differ from the sepsis patient. Like you said, everybody has a number 65 pounded into their head. And in the sepsis world, I think if I'm remembering my literature correctly, I think there's a study in sepsis of driving towards a higher pressure over a lower pressure, and the lower pressure folks did just fine. And so this is an area where the cardiac arrest patients are different. And the name of the game here really is all about perfusing the brain. It's all about cerebral perfusion pressure. And just physiologically, there was a great article in the Stroke Journal from about 10 or 15 years ago, very, very eloquently delineating how the post-cardiac arrest brain preserves CO2 reactivity but completely loses the ability to autoregulate. And so this becomes important because, as I said, the brain can autoregulate. And so in that first hour that the patient's sitting in your ED, unless you drive that MAP up, you are essentially letting someone underperfuse their brain in front of you. And so, like I said, it's important to fill the tank in these patients and to adequately fluid resuscitate them, but then it's also equally important to pretty quickly turn towards pressors. And I tend to reach for levofed first. There's some observational evidence that that may be the pressor of choice in these folks, but it's important to drive that mean arterial pressure up, and the goal is really 80. We want to see that MAP hit 80 to make sure that the brain is perfusing in the midst of its inability to autoregulate.
That's great, great pearl. Now let me ask you as well, a lot of the patients in the first few hours following Roski will develop some degree of cardiac dysfunction. And I've seen it as high, quoted in the literature, as perhaps 70% of these folks. So in addition to, say, your norepinephrine, are you routinely or more often than not considering an inotrope such as dobutamine in their care or early hours of care?
Yeah, it's something I'm thinking about and definitely keeping as an option in the back of my mind. I can tell you at least most of my in-depth intensive experience with post-arrest patients is in Western Pennsylvania. And at least in patients that live there, we did in fact see a lot of post-arrest myocardial dysfunction. That's very, very common. The good thing about these types of patients is that it's usually reversible. You really should be able to get these patients off pressors in a couple days. Most of the myocardial dysfunction is reversible after 40 to 72 hours. But at least in most of the patients I did, their degree of myocardial dysfunction was rarely so bad as to need a lot of inotropic support. So at most, we were putting on patients on some dobutamine, occasionally some norinone, but it was pretty rare that they needed a lot of intense inotropy.
Now, switching over to management or optimizing oxygenation and ventilation, what are you shooting for your FiO2 target, or actually pulse oximetry target? And then since we've already got these patients on end-tidal CO2, what are you shooting for in terms of ventilation for these patients now that we've obtained ROSC?
Yeah, well, I'll talk about ventilation first. So as I said before, the brain completely is unable to autoregulate but does preserve CO2 reactivity. So as important as it is to drive the mean arterial pressure up, provided that the heart can tolerate it, it's equally as important to ventilate towards normocarbia because that brain still is very sensitive to changes in CO2. Yeah, so just that. So ventilate towards normocarbia. And in terms of oxygenation, you know, there's a lot of general awareness now about free radical generation and oxidative stress. So my rule of thumb is to get the IFIO2 down as quick as you can while still maintaining normoxia. So we don't need pulse oximeters of 100%. Mid-90s is perfectly fine for these folks. Or if you prefer to look at PO2s, you know, just normal PO2s. We don't need an abundance of oxygen in these folks.
Well, let me ask your opinion on cardiac cath lab activation. I think we're all on board the fact that if a post-arrest or pre-arrest ECG demonstrates a STEMI, we're sending that patient to the cath lab ASAP, just as if this patient hadn't been in cardiac arrest. But where are you falling in terms of the non-STEMI, or sort of more often the non-diagnostic post-arrest EKG?
Yeah, great question. So I should say that the post-arrest EKG is not 100% reliable. There's some emerging literature about the degradation and sensitivity for STEMI in the post-arrest EKG. And so really, I think it's helpful to think about STEMI equivalence and sort of shape the discussion that way. So for me, I think we're probably under-triaging these folks to the cath lab. If you look across the literature, you start to notice that the odds ratio for people going to the cath lab tends to be about 2. Patients that go to the cath lab are about twice as likely to leave the hospital with a neurologically favorable status. And so I think it's helpful to think about what are the STEMI equivalents in this patient. Does the patient come in with a shockable rhythm? Does the patient have a known history of coronary disease? Is there some suspicious clinical feature about the case that really makes you suspect a cardiac cause or potential coronary lesion? And I think more often than not, I think the burden of proof is on us to say that this is a non-cardiac etiology. I think the patients that have an obvious non-cardiac cause, the hangings, the drownings, the asphyxias, you know, those patients, I think, don't need to go to the cath lab. But in the absence of some obvious non-cardiac etiology, I think the default should be to send them. There are more things to do in the cath lab besides open vessels. It's an opportunity to put in balloon pumps, or nowadays moving more towards things like Impellas. It's an opportunity to get cardiology involved early at the bedside, sort of get them invested in this patient. So there are more things to do in the cath lab besides open vessels.
Well, well stated. Well, let me ask two things to wrap up this sort of post-arrest discussion. I think something that many of us aren't thinking about, certainly we're focused on the other things we just mentioned, but seizures that probably occur a lot more often than we would think. What do you say?
Yeah, absolutely. In Pittsburgh, we saw about a 10 to 20% incidence of seizures in these folks, many of them being non-convulsive. I really have to credit, to give a shout out here to John Rittenberger, who is really sort of leading the way in this. For a long, long time, seizures were sort of the death nail or the death toll for these folks. We thought that if a post-cardiac arrest patient had a seizure, that was it. Might as well turn off the ventilator, tell the family there's nothing more to do. These folks, there's nothing more we can do for them. And we're finding that's just patently not true. A lot of people have seizures. A lot of people have non-convulsive seizures. And it really highlights or underscores the need for these folks to go to essentially a cardiac arrest center where they can follow a well-worn path. And a part of that path includes EEG monitoring. And what we found that was by actually treating these seizures, actually being pretty aggressive with anti-epileptic therapy, in some cases we could actually suppress the malignant EEG rhythms and patients sometimes woke up, and the reason they weren't waking up is because they were having a seizure.
Well stated. Well, last topic, and then we'll kind of wrap things up here. In terms of prognostication, it's something that you alluded to a few times early in our discussion about just moving through the cardiac arrest. What's the end point? Where are we going? But let's just say we get ROSC, we institute a lot of the pearls, and hopefully avoid the pitfalls we just discussed in post-arrest care. But in terms of prognostication, hard to do probably in the ED, correct?
Yeah, just about impossible. There's just about the one thing you can do in terms of prognostication in the ED is it's sort of a little bit off topic. There are some ways to get sort of an initial estimate of illness severity and an initial estimate of what the neurologic trajectory for this patient is going to be. But beyond that, it's impossible to get a firm sense of this in the ED. It's really something that evolves even beyond the 72 hours that we think about, something that takes anywhere between 3 and 7 days to get a sense of, and really should be a multimodal process consisting of daily neurologic exams, EEG, MRI, SSEP, and time to establish an initial estimate of where we're going and then see how the trajectory shapes up over 3 to 7 days.
Outstanding. Well, Josh, you have given us just an enormous amount of pearls and pitfalls during this discussion of cardiac arrests and then some nice, nice post-arrest pearls. Any final thoughts as we kind of wrap up our discussion?
Yeah, I think, as I said before, the overarching theme should be algorithms important and recipes are important. It keeps us all on the same page. But when you actually have a dead person in front of you getting CPR, I think the most important thing to think about is where are we going? What's the end game? Is this somebody that's a candidate for more aggressive therapy? And probably more important than that, what's the reversible cause that I can find and treat? And then in terms of the post-arrest patients, drive the MAP up to 80, ventilate to normal carbia, turn down the FiO2. I'll say these patients inevitably crump an hour after they get pulses back. So you might as well start mixing the levofed once you get pulses back. Yeah, and then certainly don't write them off. You know, just because they're not doing anything in the ED doesn't mean they're not going to wake up upstairs.
Thanks so much for an awesome discussion. We really appreciate having you here on the podcast, and certainly more to come from an expert resuscitationist. Our thanks.
Oh, thanks for being here. Appreciate it a lot.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up our discussion with Dr. Josh Reynolds on the modern management of cardiac arrest. Let me just take a few minutes and go back over some of those really key points that we chatted about during this discussion. I think probably one of the more important things, and as Josh indicated, is a relatively new concept over the past few years in resuscitating patients with cardiac arrest, and that's hemodynamic-directed resuscitation. As John Greenwood alluded to a few months ago in our discussion there, we're really attempting to achieve a coronary perfusion pressure or an adequate coronary perfusion pressure to restore myocardial blood flow. Now, in many cases, we are not going to have that A-line or central venous access to really truly determine CPP. So using waveform capnography, titrating or looking for, as Josh indicated, an increasing trend in end-tidal CO2. If you're able to get an A-line, targeting a diastolic pressure probably around 40 to 45 is something that Josh does in trying to obtain an adequate coronary perfusion pressure. I think one of the things that we didn't really get into with much depth during our discussion is that when that patient rolls in, or even before the patient rolls in, you have got to establish team leadership. Poor performance of CPR is definitely linked to insufficient team management. There's a few papers that have come out in the Journal of Critical Care, along with resuscitation, highlighting the fact that deficits in leadership, poor functioning equipment, poor communication really can cost the life of a patient who may have otherwise survived. So be the team leader, identify yourself, check your equipment, direct all components of the resuscitation, set clear expectations with your staff on how this resuscitation is going to run. Take a hands-off approach so you can really look at things globally. You can look and focus on the person who is doing chest compressions. You can make decisions about prognosis. When making those decisions, be decisive and definitely remain calm during the resuscitation. Leadership is hugely important in successfully managing that patient with cardiac arrest. Josh's pearls on high-quality CPR. One of the big things is targeting a chest compression fraction greater than 80%. So in order to do that, we're absolutely going to minimize interruptions. Once again, as the team leader, you need to clearly communicate about potentially impending pauses and make sure your team is ready to perform simultaneous actions. Minimize, if not eliminate, pulse checks. Use end-tidal CO2 as a method to monitor your resuscitation, your compressions. Minimize the time for advanced airway placement. As you heard, Josh likes a supraglottic airway during the initial few minutes of the resuscitation. And then in terms of perishock pauses, charge that defibrillator during compressions, and as soon as you deliver that shock, resume compressions for at least 1 to 2 minutes before you perform a post-shock rhythm analysis. Make sure you have a compression rate of 100 to 120 per minute. As you heard Josh say, the literature is probably falling more towards 120 per minute. Adequate depth of about 2 inches in adults, allowing full recoil, and make sure that you look as the team leader for that person doing compressions and avoid leaning. As you heard, in terms of mechanical CPR devices, at the present time, there's no statistical difference in survival with the use of mechanical devices, but certainly there's a role in select settings. As you heard Josh say, initiating ECMO is probably one of the more common reasons to use an automatic or a mechanical device, but as of yet, the literature has not shown a statistically significant difference in patient outcome. In terms of medications, Josh gave some great pearls with respect to epinephrine dosing. Other medications, atropines out, routine calcium, bicarbonate, TPA, don't work. They may have a role in those select circumstances, but in general, these medications are not efficacious. Same with antiarrhythmics, no studies showing a benefit in terms of survival to hospital discharge with any antiarrhythmic medication. In terms of ultrasound, absolutely use it. Use it initially to make sure there's no rapidly reversible cause of the patient's cardiac arrest, but pay attention in terms of the frequency with which you use it throughout the remainder of your resuscitation. Make sure you're not using it so much that you're really decreasing the chest compression fraction. And then in terms of ECMO and ECLS, I'll refer you back to Josh in terms of the literature as to what the current patient indication is or selection is. Lots of discussion in the literature, a bunch of studies coming out on the use of ECPR for patients who have refractory cardiac arrest. And what does refractory mean? Well, according to Josh's publication in Circulation, it's probably about 10 to 15 minutes if that patient isn't responding to all the therapies that we've just talked about. That's when you want to consider moving to the novel therapies, namely ECMO. In terms of post-arrest, some quick pearls. Once again, ventilating the patient to normocarbia, targeting that end-tidal CO2 of about 35 to 40, turning down the FiO2 to target saturations of about 94% or above, targeting a higher mean arterial pressure. So using targeted temperature management, and he highlighted some really great pitfalls with targeted temperature management. Inadequate volume resuscitation for these patients who develop a cold diuresis, thinking about potassium, and then in terms of paralyzing these patients, not walking away from the ventilator. Getting those patients to cath, not relying so much on the post-arrest ECG, as we know it is unreliable in this particular setting. Working with your cardiology colleagues to determine a protocol or pathway of who is going to go for emergent cardiac cath. And finally, don't forget about seizures in the post-arrest patient, a very high incidence of non-convulsive status epilepticus. So if that patient isn't waking up, really strongly consider continuous EEG monitoring to detect those 1 out of 5 who may be in non-convulsive status epilepticus. All right, well, that's going to do it for this month. Our thanks finally to Josh. If you have any questions, anything for follow-up, please email us through the website. I'll shoot those questions over to him and we'll get you a reply. For those of you going to AAEM in Austin, Texas, looking forward to meeting up with many of you. I know lots of you have signed up for the resuscitation pre-conference course. A tremendous amount of top-notch speakers in emergency medicine are going to be in Austin in just the next week. So hope to see many of you there. And if not, we will talk to you in the March 2015 podcast. Bye for now.